Welcome back to Following Noah Dharma Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 216, and we're in Tress 32 through 42. Paul, how are you?
Never, ever have I ever been better. That's not true.
I don't believe you.
At some point, but I'm trying to hype it up for everyone, okay? I'm doing really good this week. You know, nothing super crazy right now, but I hope that there will be in a little bit.
Elliot?
I am doing really well. I did have to cram a little bit for this episode. I was a little bit behind in my reading, so I did read like four or five of these chapters today. But this book does read quite quickly, so it actually wasn't too bad. You can cruise to this book pretty fast.
It's true. Let's roll intro and then get a summary of what Elliot read today. All right, 32 through 42 of Tress of the Emerald Sea. Go, Elliot.
All right. So we learned a lot last episode. We learn a bit more in these set of chapters. The crew of the ship thinks they learned something about Tress. They think that she's an assassin who's in disguise and pretending to not know about sailing and all these things. And the more Tress tries to convince them otherwise, the more they're sure that she's a king's mask, whatever that means, assassin of some kind. But Tress does successfully convince Captain Crow to set course for the Crimson Sea in an attempt, I think, to just avoid other ships so they can stop killing people at Crow's orders. Lo and behold, and she kind of knew this already, Captain Crow wants to go to the Crimson Sea. Later on, Tress discovers that Crow intends to trade her to the dragon to get her healing. So Tress may have just signed herself up for a not so good fate. Maybe we'll see as we keep reading. Chapter 34, Hoid tells a very long story about poop. And then later on, they shoot some cannonballs at various places. There's a fantastic chapter that goes into very nice detail about the makeup and design of a cannonball, which I'm very excited to talk to you about that. We learn more about some different kinds of spores. We learn about the Crimson Sea and the red spores and how they make sharp spikes that shoot into things, and that there's rain in the Crimson Sea, or more specifically, there's unpredictable rain. Apparently elsewhere there's predictable rain, so you just sail around it. And in the Crimson Sea, that's not true. And as you can probably figure out real fast, rain on an ether spore sea, very, very dangerous. And we get to see a little bit towards the end of some of these chapters. I mentioned cannon firing. Tress apparently gets designated for training on the cannon. So she gets to do a little bit of that. And oh yeah, we wrap up with Tress volunteering to help Fort with the cooking, and she blows everyone's minds with some tasty bread.
Very nice. Okay. So our three main non-Doug crewmates are Soleil, Fort, and Anne. Yes? I mean, we have the three other ones of like Hoid, Ulam, and Tress, and Crow, and Laggard. But the three main officers on the ship are apparently our protagonists along with Tress. And they sit her down and they tell her, okay, you can stop hiding. We know you're a super secret agent. And Tress is like, no. And then they keep telling her that and like, oh, we know you can't admit it, but we know you're a super secret agent, to the point where it kind of like upsets Tress and she gets kind of frustrated with it. She's like, I've been honest with you guys this entire time and now you're accusing me of lying. which I thought was a funny chapter. What did you guys get from that one?
This was incredibly ironic because it's Tress is telling the truth, but because she's telling the truth, they are believing that she's lying because the truth she's saying is the lie that the super secret agent would have to say.
Sure.
So it's just a total, like, I don't even know what you call that. It's just a total, like, logic circle that she can't get out of, you know, unless other evidence is provided. So this is just pretty, pretty comical.
I think that she does start to enjoy it at one point, though, because she realizes that she could attempt to convince them otherwise by coming out and saying she is the spy, because that's the one thing the spy is forbidden to say. So if she says it, then therefore she's not. But she doesn't do that. So she tries to convince them, but then kind of gets to the point where she just accepts it.
Yeah. She also gets to the point in this conversation where she realizes that if she reveals all of the information she has, they will be utterly convinced that she's the spy, because she then thinks to herself, okay, I can't tell them that I've harnessed midnight spores to spy on Captain Crow, because then they're just going to hold me on this huge pedestal of you are more powerful than Captain Crow. So she actually holds back by the end of it and does begin to not necessarily lie, but withhold truth. Paul, we have more comments about a dragon.
We do. So we know that the dragon is in the Crimson Sea.
Yes.
Right. Somewhere over there. And first of all, okay, if you're looking at the stereotypical historical dragon figure, right? You have a dragon typically on like a hoard of treasure, right? That's, I think that's the stereotypical thing.
Smaug.
Yeah. Yes, Smaug. There's others, the dragon in Narnia. There's lots of dragons that have their hoard of treasure, you know. Even not Smaug, I think other dragons did in Middle-earth. Anyways, I could be wrong with that. Either way, that's kind of the stereotypical thing. I'm assuming that's not the case here, but I feel like it is typical that a dragon might reside near something that they're trying to protect or just keep hold of or something. I'm wondering if there's something valuable here. I already know there's got to be some sort of twist with the dragon, whether the dragon is maybe not who we think it is. Maybe it's Huck. Maybe the sorceress is the dragon. Maybe maybe Charlie was the dragon the whole time. You know, there's a lot of things that could happen, I guess. You know, you don't know. So I'm obviously very excited to see the dragon, to figure out what the heck is going on. I'm actually really hoping, since it's mentioned it this much, that we will get some form of notable conversation with and notable scene from our dragon friend here, Zysis. I'm hoping we'll get something with a little bit of meat on the bones, you know?
You can't have a name like Zysis and not have something clever to contribute to the story. It just has to be true.
That's true. If your name starts with an X and is that, yeah, like cool and fantastical, like you're definitely signed up to be the cool, ominous, like, figure, you know, that comes in at the 11th hour. Maybe we'll see the dragon will join them to defeat the sorceress. If it is a black and white, like evil sorceress, that'd be cool. There's really lots of options here, I'd say.
All right, Paul and Elliot, you guys are putting your money that either the dragon or the sorceress is not what they seem. If you had to say one is our antagonist and one is a twist, like maybe protagonist, or at least not what, you know, not what they seem, which one is the straightforward antagonist and which one is not?
I will definitely say that I think the sorceress would be the straightforward antagonist. I think our dragon, it's pretty ambiguous to me. I'm imagining a third-party dragon. I'm imagining a dragon who is not not necessarily like an ally or an enemy, just like the ants, you know, or something. Nobody's on, they're not on anyone's side because nobody's on their side or something. I'm imagining a dragon that imagine dragons also. Sorry, I just caught myself saying that. So I'm imagining dragons that that so sorry. It's the most I've ever broken, Trevor. Also, it's the reddest my face has maybe ever been on here. It's because my shirt's red. It makes it worse. Okay. I'm imagining that this dragon...
It really wasn't that funny.
It was not.
Okay, starting fresh. I have to use a different
word. I'm fine. You need to get it together.
I'm not even looking at you.
That's actually pretty funny that we've gone 216 episodes without getting to the make ourselves laugh so much we can't keep going moment.
Yeah. Okay. I keep envisioning this dragon as just not on it. I'm sorry. I can't. I'm trying to look away to not laugh. Just forget it. I'm not talking about dragons anymore. Because I'm referencing some stupid band name that's totally irrelevant to what we're talking about.
Throws me back to 2013, man.
You can imagine dragons. What a top meme. Let me wait further than I should have. Okay. My guess is that our dragon friend is going to be the morally ambiguous character. Maybe not morally, but at least where the dragon's allegiance will lie is just going to be ambiguous or complex. I think Elliot mentions a lot the dragon. That's why that Brandon Sanderson writes these complex, you know, villains or other characters. So
I think I'm with you in that I think the dragon more likely to be not what we think. I am getting more and more of the feeling that we're headed for a classic fairy tale. The sorceress is just going to be probably not simple because Brandon writes pretty well-written, complex, logical motive, you know, kind of characters, but maybe just very simply, she's got a massive chip on her shoulder and she is out to wreck the world. And then the dragon is the one that's like, oh, ominous big dragon. Oh, wait, it's the wise, maybe not quite on your side, but it's going to give you that, you know, hint you need to defeat the sorceress kind of character.
While we're talking about it, predictions, gentlemen, have we seen either the dragon or the sorceress before?
Oh.
Okay. No? In the sense that it's possible, right? We've talked about the possibility that maybe Huck is the dragon. You know, that's a bit of a far-fetched theory still, but if dragons are canonically shapeshifters, it's not impossible. If that's the case, then I think yes. If not, then I think we have not met the dragon before, but the sorceress is pretty... could kind of be anyone, I guess. It's possible that that's a crossover character. But my actual prediction is no. I think it would be an original character. However, if one of them is to be, it would be the sorceress, is my guess.
Okay. No, yeah. No blush weaver hanging out on the planet as the sorceress.
Our Nalthians do seem to be rather world hoppy. And we didn't already see a reference to Naltha in this book, so.
Yeah, now that you say that, we see evidence of them. We don't really see them. Right? Like, we've seen Vasher and we've seen Azure. But, I mean, I don't know. I feel like we get more Lantern references than Warbreaker references, personally.
That's true. Is it possible that we have Sisebron here as a dragon or something? That'd be pretty wild. If you want to go really crazy crossover.
It would be pretty wild.
Don't know how that would work, so I'm just going to leave that one out. It's not confirmed, like, you know, Shalana's Light Song is a bit more tangible. True. Yeah.
We get, I don't even know if this counts, but we get a Hoid therapy session talking to nobody about nothing. It's not even relevant. He like literally shoehorns it in. I'm going to tell you this story because I want to put a one-liner at the end of the chapter. It's extremely random.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to talk about this. I assume we're talking about the Tosher.
The Tosher.
The Tosher. Excuse me. The Tosher. So Hoy tells us the story, and I was a bit confused. This was different because we see Hoid stories. Hoid loves his stories. It's really something special to him. He loves them and he shares them to someone who typically he thinks needs to hear it. You know, we see this in a lot of our stories. Notably, Stormlight, we get it a couple times. But here, it's different because at the end, he just tells what the meaning should be, or at least some of the significance. Mm-hmm. Which every time we've seen him give his little therapy session to an in-world character, I feel like he makes a specific point to either try not to say what it means or to try to get them to guess what it means or say it has no meaning. It's whatever you take from it or something along those lines.
He does go out of his way to say, the story was mine, but the meaning is yours. You know, he says that a couple times, yes. Like, make of it what you will. Not this time.
Yes. At this time, it's he just tells the story of the Tosher who, if you're listening to this, you probably read it, but the Tosher is like the lowliest of the low of the servants, you know, and this Tosher takes it into his own hands because they stop serving takes it into his own hands to better his position. And by bettering his position, he's wanting the food that is served to be potatoes again and not cornbread. So he naturally goes to the cook who says, hey, I don't want cornbread anymore. You better start making them taters. And she says, I'm just cook the food that is provided. You're going to have to talk to, I forgot who it was exactly, the whoever. And then he goes and talks to whoever else it was. And they're like, no, it was actually the king's decision. So he goes and talks to the king. And then it kind of flips on his head because the king is like, wait, are you the one who started taking two potatoes? Once you started taking two potatoes, then everyone started taking two potatoes. And your decision to do that had absolutely like transformed the demand on potatoes and made them too expensive. So that's why we no longer have potatoes. And his whole synopsis was even little decisions have an importance. And I was like, wow, that was quite the way of selling that. But oddly enough, it kind of landed for me. I thought that was kind of neat. after just a very ridiculous story. Yeah, I thought it was fairly neat. And I do think, you know, practically, little decisions do have importance, you know. And so that was neat. But other than that, I mean, it did feel a bit... This is where really it feels like Brandon is just writing this book to have some fun. Like, this is his stress relief. I imagine at the end of the day is he's like, I want to write the most ridiculous little parable about some unknown role in a kingdom that no one even has heard of. And maybe I'll try to add a little one-liner of significance in there. You know, this just felt very, this felt very much like it had its little home in a secret project, not in a mainline story, you know?
So what you said there of wanting to put in what he's always wanted to include, I feel like there are a lot of these scenes that have been cut from a different book, and he was disappointed, so he put them in here. Specifically, I get that feeling where Tress is talking to Ulam, and he has an ear on his arm, and or his leg or something. And at the end of the scene, he says, anyway, ear regardless. And I was like, Brandon, you wrote this entire scene to make that joke.
Yes.
He wrote the entire scene to make that joke. And I was, it's that one specifically that gets to me on this. I'm like, this was cut from a Mistborn book. And you held on to it for so long. You're like, I need to put this in somewhere. And he wrote this entire scene to put in ear regardless, talking about an ear. It was very funny.
The puns throughout this whole book have been terrible in the great way that terrible puns can be throughout.
And I do appreciate Trust for that, because you can't put this in a Stormlight book. You can't put it in a Mistborn book. It's too, you know, it would yank you out too dramatically. But in Trust, the whole thing is just over the top and ridiculous. So putting this type of stuff in, it does make you laugh. And
yeah, it seems very much in the vein of no more rhymes now, I mean it.
Anyone want a peanut?
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're
welcome. That was a great reference. Very on the nose for our story.
Tress gets the opportunity to return some favors to the crew finally. So the crew has been helping her this whole book of kind of bringing her up to speed on how to be a pirate, saving her life to start with, et cetera, et cetera. In this episode, she begins to pay it back, right? She learns through firsthand experience that Anne is very, very, very bad at aiming cannons and aiming revolvers. So while Anne can explain the fundamentals to her, she cannot do it practically. And so then Tress says, oh, well, you should train with me. Nobody else will let you touch a gun or a cannon, but, you know, I'm crazy enough to. So come train with me and we can go target practice with these, with the cannon. And for Fort, the poor guy has been thrust into the cook position after being the quartermaster, and he's really bad at cooking and he's embarrassed about it. He's really like trying his best here. And this whole time Tress has assumed that maybe he was giving her the scraps at the end of the meal or deliberately giving her stuff that tasted bad because he didn't trust her or something like that. No, this is the best he has. This is him doing his best for the entire crew. And Tress, her whole life, has brushed together meals with scraps back on the rock. So Tress is like, this is something I can do, and teaches him how to cook with, you know, dried meat and a couple seasonings, and that's it. So what do you guys think?
Well, both of those scenes are more than they seem on the surface, though, which is actually fantastic. The Fort one especially. It's not just that she comes in and helps him cook or teaches him how to do it. She notices that for him, the art of a deal is important. And by the end of that chapter, we realize just how important. It's like, that's the whole point for him, is striking really good deals. And so she leans into that. She plays along. She spends the whole chapter in this elongated haggle where they're haggling back and forth over this and trying to trick each other into revealing, you know, what each other person thinks is valuable. And by the end of it, she's amazed by how satisfied he is at the end. Not that he got help, but the fact that he had such a satisfying and such a thorough battle of wits with her in this deal is actually really interesting. There's layers to the chapter.
I want to highlight actually that I think it's really impactful that Tress's that this is all happening around food. That may sound silly, but I mean, it is remarkable how much impacts a person by their food, your mood, your physical well-being. There's so many things that are impacted by food. There's a reason that it's special for people to share a meal, and that's a common thing. And it's, right. You know, you see in, you know, Stormlight, you see characters sharing, you know, a good soup and stuff, and how it's like it's a notable bonding moment that anyone can relate to. So I think it's pretty significant that the root of Tress kind of getting in on the crew's good side might start with some good, you know, help in their food situation, you know?
Yeah.
Because if you suddenly improve that, you're going to have a lot of people who are your friend now, you know? That's like I feel like there's that age old saying of the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, you know? And, you know, we don't have to dive that deep into it, but I think it's really a really cool point that Tress is helping their food situation. And I'm like, that's definitely bound to earn her some kudos, you know, for sure, with these crew members who probably haven't had nothing but maggoty bread for three stinking days, you know. They've they haven't had any good food in a while. And so just even a step up to something that seems edible, they're going to be pretty excited about.
And the food thing has been a very consistent motif throughout the book, ever since like the first paragraph of the book that is describing Tress's hair with all these different kinds of food. It's been very much a thing throughout the book, centered around food.
And her making pies for Charlie, mm-hmm. and trading pies at the tavern for favors and stuff like that. Yeah.
And Huck eating her toe or whatever else he does.
Yeah, that was odd.
Isn't the line he says after he like bites her toe? He said, well, I said I would. I'm totally butchering this. He says something along the lines of, I said I would take a bite out of whoever was hurting you or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, whoever's it? Fault this was. Yeah.
Yeah, whoever's fault this was, and bites her toe. And it's, I was a touch confused. I'll be honest. I was a smidgen lost.
I don't know if I have an answer for you. It's, I don't know if Huck was trying to be funny or what, but you know.
Yeah. It was a bit peculiar is the word I'd use for it. One thing I want to ask y'all about and want to talk to y'all about is the Crimson Sea, if that's all right.
Sure.
So the Crimson Sea is where Tress is trying to convince everyone to go to, because the Crimson Sea borders the Midnight Sea. So she's trying to convince the crew to be willing to go there so that she'll kind of, that's her step towards getting permission to go there. So she's trying to do that. But they talk a bit about the Crimson Sea, of why you shouldn't go there. It's very perilous, the unpredictable rain. And this, I really, you know, I mentioned in our last episode, I've really gotten invested in the world here. I think it's a very fascinating world. First off, I didn't realize how much of this world was water or spores,
mm-hmm.
you know, but how much sea is on this world? Tress is shocked and surprised to learn that there are some land masses that are 40 miles across or 60 miles across or something like that. And that's like astounding to her. And I was just thinking about how crazy that is. If you have a whole world that like you just have seems like some tiny little islands, you know, like it's just predominantly sea, I guess, which is really crazy.
But I really want to see a picture of the planet actually with 12 moons that are fairly close to it because they're raining these spores down, all different colors, covered with seas, 12 different seas. That's got to look really unique. I wonder if any artists have attempted that yet.
I agree. I feel like that would be a challenging, this would be one of the more challenging worlds to portray. But yes, I fully agree. I would love to see a globe of this planet. Absolutely. Okay, so with the Crimson Sea, it's infamously dangerous because it's unpredictable rain. It just says on a whim, there could just be a strip of rain right over you, and it's just pure luck as to whether or not you could sail across it safely, right? And Brandon puts a lot of emphasis on describing how rain interacts with this sea, and it's really comical to me because he's like, if you're a meteorologist nerd, like, here's the details for you, and then continues on. And I'm like, wow, I mean, I didn't think about that, but I'm sure there's people who either are meteorologists or like meteorology and are fascinated by that, and so they need the details to them. They've probably been wondering the whole time, what happens if it rains here? Does it rain? And me, I haven't even thought about it until Brandon mentioned it here. But he says whenever it rains, you know, the spikes, the sprouts shoot up, and because I guess it's solid, they sink down.
Yep.
Like the spikes start sinking into the spores, rinse and repeat. And this was really hard for me to wrap my brain around how this could look visually. Because I'm like, you know, these spores are pretty crazy. They touch water and they shoot off like almost like fireworks or something. You know, they sprout rapidly, super quick. And so them like rapidly sprouting but sinking, I'm like, it's just a crazy visual. But I was really enticed, like just trying to think of how that could look. I don't know, it was very enticing to me. And how, you know, encompassing rain is, you know, over just a surface. It just really got me thinking. I'm like, that's really crazy. And also, you know, are they going to have to weather that? Or are we just going to get lucky? Or what's going to happen here?
I had the distinct visual in my brain of a really small, concentrated, like, water spout storm. Like, not like a storm wall or a normal thunderstorm that we'd see that's, you know, several miles across. I was thinking something more along the lines of, like, 600 feet across. And it's just, like, traveling in this little cartoonish storm cloud. That's the idea I got. I don't know if that's what you're supposed to get, but that's what I got.
I'm not saying you're right or wrong or I'm right or wrong. The way that I have been picturing it is like you have the whole, imagine if you're like super zoomed out view, like you're looking down onto this planet. You can see the entirety of the Crimson Sea. I'm imagining that you see like... trying to think of a good way to picture it. Almost like static. I'm imagining it just like interspersing over the area, like clouds and rain fading in and out in just random spots across the surface of it. Because it sounds like you really don't have warning. Like you're not, it sounds like you're not seeing a cloud coming. Let's steer away or speed up or slow down or something to avoid it. It's like, 1 minute you're not in anything, the next minute it's raining on top of you or something like that. But I have no idea. But that's how I've kind of pictured it. Elliot, do you have any? Did you get a clear picture of how this works?
I don't know if I got a clear picture, but I was thinking similar along the lines of Trevor you were talking about actually, because if this is just a blanket of cloud over all over and it's just raining everywhere, the entire sea is going to be erupting with whatever that spore creates. And so it's not even an ocean at that point. It's a giant maelstrom of vines or spikes, or if it's the Zephyr Sea, just explosions.
Explosions. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So for it to even be comprehensible seems like it has to be that like fast moving curtain of rain that passes over you in, you know, 5 minutes. It like downpours on you for 5 minutes and then it's gone. And, you know, sometimes you're driving and you'll see it off in the distance, like that small ish storm cloud with that visible curtain of rain underneath it. It seems like it has to be some version of that for it not to be just overwhelming. Or maybe it's just overwhelming.
Do you guys have that in Texas, Paul? We have, when we get a thunderstorm, it like moves across in half an hour and it's done.
Yeah, I'd say I feel like the common adage around here is that it'll rain really hard, but it'll be over fairly quick. You know, it's kind of rare that it rains for prolonged periods.
Sure.
While we're talking about the Crimson Sea, Paul, I wanted to describe some things for you that if you're an audiobook listener, you're probably missing out on. And this was a really impactful moment in the design and the art of this book. We haven't talked about the art a ton in this book. It's been great. I've been enjoying it a lot. But the usage of the art piece that's in this chapter is actually really cool. Have you, Paul, have you seen the physical copies of the Secret Projects here and seen like kind of the style and the art and the gilding?
I have. Yes, I have the book, but at least for the most recent two episodes we've recorded, I have not looked to see if there's any artwork in those chapters.
Okay.
I have flipped through to look.
When we're done recording, you need to go pick up the book and you need to go flip to the end of chapter 39. Trevor's showing you something I'm going to talk about too. Yeah. So up until now, from chapters 1 through 39, there's been these, you know, bits of art, but the color design has been exclusively green. Everything has been green. There's little green accents at the top of each page. There's a few sections where like we're reading Captain Crow's journal and or text or book or whatever she has. And it's actually green ink text, which is what Trevor was showing there a second ago. Pretty cool. In the exact moment in the story where the ship sails from Verdant Sea into Crimson Sea, you turn the page and you get this, which my webcam is not going to do this near justice. But on the left page, you get the ship in the green sea, and everything in that picture is green. On the right page, you see the Crimson Sea, and everything on that page is red. Everything to the left, everything behind this green half of this piece of artwork is all that green design. You flip the page and go to chapter 40, and now all of our accents are in red. There's red ink designs on the pages. The special highlight text is red. And it continues that way for the next couple of chapters while we're continuing on in the Crimson Sea. It was just a really cool design moment, a really cool visual addition to what I was reading and going to my imagination, because now the book in front of me just changed. We had a massive moment in the story where we left the Verdant Sea and into the Crimson, and the literal book I'm holding in front of me just changed. It hit me at a level that I've not really experienced in a book before, of the literal design of the book I'm reading just shifted with the story. Crazy cool.
That is one of the coolest things ever. This is probably the most FOMO I've ever had from not reading the physical book. Is hearing about that is a really clever transition.
A little bit of a teaser for next episode.
Ooh.
You have it's 58 and it's one number is in red and one number is in black.
Black. Uh-huh. I've never been so intrigued by black ink.
Ooh.
Whoa, the words are in black in this part. That's crazy. Yeah.
Standard black ink. Whoa.
Oh my gosh. Did he use Times New Roman? That's monumental.
Yes. I also noticed that when I flipped through the book, and it is pretty cool to experience it. I haven't sat down and read this book. I've done audiobook three times. I've listened to this, but I have flipped through my book. So yeah, rain in the Crimson Sea, not rain in the other seas, which, well, it's not that there's no rain, it's that there's predictable rain. And Paul, you mentioned earlier that Hoyd or Brandon has an off comment of, for all you meteorologist nerds out there, I'd like to pause on that thought for a second. Meteorologist nerds out in the audience, if there's no water ocean, I contend that there's no rain. if the water cycle in third grade told me anything, is that there would be no rain if there's no ocean.
This has been a question in my head of, you're right, we do have water supply, but are they, is it coming from like springs or wells in the ground? Or
Tress says that all the water she's ever seen has come from wells and springs.
Okay. Maybe there's like one ocean that's a good, normal, good old fashioned normal water ocean, maybe.
It definitely seems logical that there would be far less water on the planet as a whole if you don't have oceans. You know, Earth is 71% surface area water or something crazy like that. We have a lot of water all over the place. This planet would seem to have far, far, far less if it's covered in sandy spores all over. So surely the rain is going to be far less. There's going to be far less clouds, would be my guess. But I just had a thought as you were talking there, just the concept of a water cycle. I'm curious how that works, because if you're dropping your water onto these ether spores that are what I was kind of assuming up to this point, consuming it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like your planet's just going to straight up run out of water. Mm-hmm. Like it's just going to all be gone after a amount of time. But there's a second part of this that was confusing me as well, actually, which might be an answer somehow, actually. They're describing the rain as it goes over the ocean and it creates these, like in the Crimson Sea, these giant spikes. They shoot up everywhere, spikes going crazy, and then they sink into the ocean. I had a thought about that too, because if that is happening over and over and over, isn't your ocean going to just eventually fill up with spikes? Like it sinks to the bottom, but if it keeps doing that year after year after year, like your entire ocean just becomes spikes.
Your spore level rises.
You're right. What if though they sink to the bottom of the ocean and then somehow release their water back in down into like the crust of the planet at the bottom. And then it goes into like aquifers and then up into like freshwater lakes and wells and things like that. And then a small amount evaporates up. So you have like this mini water cycle somehow.
Maybe. I don't know. You're muted.
But hold on. I'm going to refute myself for a second though, because we just got told that it was extremely important that the ethers are like feeding off the water.
Right.
The ethers are like consuming the water. That's the problem. Tress bonds with the midnight essence and almost gets killed through dehydration because the ether is sucking it all up. So yeah, how do we not run out of water if the ethers are just sucking it all up?
Well, I don't have an answer to your question, but what I was thinking was, we know that air is coming up through the spores, right? That's what makes it a pseudo liquid.
Yes.
Is that air is
fluidization.
Yes. So I don't know. I don't know where that exactly how that's all working, but in my head, that means that the water couldn't be getting reabsorbed through the planet's core or whatever. I don't know, maybe, but I don't really know how you get a steady flow of air underneath your planet anyways. So we need some like meteorologists and geologists to come help us out. I think we need a special guest.
I've got it. Ready? Before the moons show up, or alternatively, before the ethers show up on the moons, it's a water planet. And the core or the inner crust of the planet is water. And then the grown ether spores have created a crust. And so the spores are on top. You have sunken, whatever, grown spores. And then you have water on the bottom.
Maybe.
And that's why the moons are reaching towards it, because it's a core of water.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't think so, Trev. Sorry.
I'll retreat. Any one-liners in this episode that you guys caught? There's several in this book all over, but
I'll take us into a interesting discussion or thoughts that were springing to my mind. There's a running discourse now on the nature of memories. It's come up at least twice, maybe three times, where Hoyd goes rambling for a paragraph about the nature of memories. And there's one section in chapter 36, which really caught my eye, where he talks about like the varying nature of aging memories and how we don't necessarily remember things exactly as they happened. I think his phrase is they sour or sweeten over time, like a brew we drink, then recreate later by taste, only getting the ingredients mostly right. And then later on, in the last chapter we read, 42, he follows it up with another discussion about memories, but kind of takes the like a different approach on it and ends the discussion with a rather strong statement of basically saying, like, enjoy your memories, but don't let them control you. Those memories aren't alive. You are.
Mm.
And both discussions I thought were really interesting. They made me think, but then I was kind of left with the question of like, okay, Hoyd, what are you telling me? Are you just rambling about memories, or are you trying to give me something pithy about memories?
It is interesting that they're brought up several different times and then not really delved into at that time. It's kind of just a recurring thing, because Tress and Huck have a conversation about this where they're kind of talking to each other. Tress, it's actually the toe biting scene where Tress is kind of given up and Huck says, well, wouldn't it be nice to just, you know, go back home and live happily like we did when we were kids? Like, you know, I have good memories of my home. You probably have good memories of your home. Wasn't it so nice when we were young and didn't know any of the life's problems? And Tress said, yes, but I don't think it was actually like that. I think we were just ignorant. So it is interesting that there's several different times that's bringing up like your old life and how nice it was, and but do you really want to go back, and you know, stuff like that.
And we probably don't have time to go into it now, but it actually reminded me of Shallan. I actually wrote up a few thoughts on this in our Discord, where I post my live reactions as I'm reading for our patrons. And Shallan has a thing for memory as well. In fact, in Stormlight, when memory is talked about around Shallan, it's capitalized in the book. And so memory for her seems to be a important aspect. She can perfectly capture memories, while at the same time, she also intentionally redacts her own memory to selectively ignore things that have happened to her. And in this chapter here in Tress, Hoyd, the narrator Hoyd, talks about memories being our foundation myth, I think he calls it. And it actually made me wonder, you know, well, maybe that explains a bit of Shallan's confused personalities that she has. She doesn't have a foundation myth because she's intentionally messed with her memories so much. And that has left her, you know, maybe open to kind of this wayward, I don't even know who I am because I've blocked out so much of my memories.
Not to get into a wider Cosmere conversation, but that's what I'm about to do. Now that you guys have a better understanding of the term identity, capital I identity, what do you think is going on with Shallan's identity? If she can genuinely manipulate her memories, like that is a fascinating conversation to be. We just came out of Mistborn, and having the idea of manipulating your identity to use someone else's, you know, metal mines or something. Could Shallan just like lie to herself and use someone else's metal mines? Like, I'm this person now. That's an odd concept, but we don't really need to.
Or have a metal mine that's coded to Vale. And
yeah,
if Shallan is not on good terms with Vale that day, Vale's just like, no, you can't use that. Sorry.
Yes. Elliot, you teased a engineering explanation corner segment What's it about?
Ready for this? Buckle up.
I'm ready.
All right. I really enjoyed chapters. I think it starts in 37. Well, actually, kind of starts in 36. So 36 all the way through 42 is actually this kind of wild ride between like philosophy discussions on memory and doing the right thing and life purpose, all mixed in with these rather technical discussions about cannons and cannonballs. And there's a whole page in the book where Hoyd says, oh yeah, I promised I would explain to you the how these cannonballs work. Let me do that. And then proceeds to go into an entire page of detailed explanation of how these cannonballs work. And I was so fascinated that I literally set down the book in that moment and said, I need to figure out how this works. I need to draw this. I need to design this cannonball that he just gave me a detailed explanation of. And it's been quite a number of years actually since I've used like a computer modeling software. So my first thought was to model up something cool in like AutoCAD, but I haven't done that in years. That would have taken me many hours to figure out. So I just said, you know what? Screw it. I pulled out some colored pencils that my kids have been using to draw all kinds of fun pictures in like kindergarten and channeled a couple things, my 5-year-old kids who love to draw pictures. And then the one drafting class that I took a really long time ago in engineering school to try and see if I could draw the schematic that Shallan comes across in the cabin of the Sprouter she just moved into. What did I say?
You said Shallan.
Oh, wow. Got Shallan on the mind, I guess.
Whoa, not crazy Shallan. Crossover revealed.
Tress. Yep. We already know who Shallan is. That one's solved. Tress is going through the stuff. She comes across a schematic. Here is my attempt at what that might look like. Let me get this to go. When that comes through, go ahead and pull that up. You might take a little bit of zooming in to see what you're looking at, but took me probably a good hour, probably longer than I should have, to sit down and try and sketch this as carefully as I could, because it's actually kind of complex, but I thought it was really cool. Hopefully Trevor can pull this up on the video as we're talking here. I'm also going to go post this in our Discord so you can take a closer look at it, because some of the sections on this are kind of detailed and require zooming in maybe a little closer than YouTube might allow you to do. But here's my take on what I think Shallan might be looking at with the schematic of these cannonballs. And because of the magic system that we've got with all these spores, it's actually really interesting to see what you can do with these different substances. So figure one at the top of this, it's just a cannonball. That's just to give you some context of what we're talking about here. There's a round cannonball, just like something in our world might look like. But the bottom two, imagine as if you cut this thing directly in half and kind of split it open. Now we're trying to look at, okay, what's inside this cannonball? So my figure two there on the right side of this, I tried to draw out and label what's going on here, because you've got three different kinds of ether spores all coming together with some fairly complex little mechanisms to make all this happen. So I'm not going to explain it all in super detail because the book kind of does that. Maybe pull up the section in chapter 37 along with my image here and you can see it all. But basically it relies on the violence of the cannonball getting thrown out of the cannon breaks a small glass vial or sphere. I kind of drew it as a sphere looking thing on the inside wall of the cannonball that holds water. That water then touches a little bit of verdant vine, which then grows, pushes a plug through the zephyr spores, which are my lighter blue color on here, to the center, breaking a rosite sphere that has more water in it. The water touches the zephyr spores, explodes your cannon. Pretty cool. Well, hopefully it doesn't explode your cannon. Explode your cannonball on your enemy. I then took it one step further. That figure two is what I think Shallan has in her hand. Like those are the cannonballs they have. It's just completely full of zephyr spores. It makes a large explosion. You could vary the amount of water that you have in there. So hopefully the whole intent is to like rain water on your enemy, right? So that it causes vines or whatever sea you're sailing in to completely destroy their ship. So there could be more water in than what I drew right here. But then I thought, well, why stop here? You could go even further with this. So my figure three adds another layer to this cannonball. So all the things I just described are all still there. The same mechanism that pushes a bit of silver into a rosite sphere that's holding your water. Water releases into a kind of smaller concentric sphere around that that has your zephyr spores, which are going to explode. But then what if you had another layer outside of that that you could fill with just about any spore you wanted? Pick your favorite terrible to deal with spore. We don't even know what most of them are. I'm assuming there's some pretty nasty ones out there. You could launch
sunlight just spores.
Oh yeah, we get a cool mention of that. Oh, you get like napalm, oh. the other
yeah.
The other ship. Yeah, oh yeah. I bet you go any kind of directions with this. Pick your favorite spore, pack it in an outer layer there. Not only can you rain water on your enemy, you could rain whatever the heck you want ether stuff on your ship. You can get really destructive with these. So there you go. Cannonballs.
Yeah, these are pretty good. Of the five spores we've gotten so far, I would definitely choose the sunlight spores, which they use to heat their food. That's some fire in a cannonball for you.
I was going to say, so first off, Elliot, I'm very impressed with your modeling here. I think it looks very crisp, very clean, very clear. Eat knocks it out of the park. It really helps my mental image for sure. About the third option, like the adding your favorite spore thing. So sunlight spores would also probably be the top choice here. If you're sort of launching fire at them, would be really cool. But my thought is, with that is, well, okay, I guess it would work well. My thought was like, whenever it explodes and you pop out all the water, all the spores in there, they're just going to eat up all the water, right? And wouldn't it actually be counterintuitive? But it would essentially do the same thing, I guess. I think I'm overthinking it.
I think you might have to like engineering design it with the right ratios. You'd have to kind of test out, you know, what's the right ratio of water to spores. Because I had the same thought too. My drawing might not have enough water in the middle there. And all those zephyr spores might soak all that up. Maybe you need a lot more water and less spores. But I bet you could find the right combo.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
I had one other thought as I was drawing this up. And Shallan multiple times goes and starts to theorize about like contact initiation of the cannonballs, of designing this such that it doesn't start the timer, because all this is timer based. When it comes out of the cannonball, out of the cannon, that's what breaks the water and starts your timer. You have to have exactly the right amount of verdant vine in there. You have to, a little bit of guesswork, how long do you think it's going to fly through the air? It's going to explode at some amount of time after. Did I say Shallan again? Tress. Tress is figuring out that if you could design a cannon that doesn't, the glass doesn't break or something doesn't break to release the water until it hits something, that might be more reliable. What I thought about with either her design or this one, these are some really dangerous cannonballs. Think about it. All of this is reliant on glass breaking and releasing water. If you're carrying one of these cannonballs across the deck of the ship over to the cannonmaster and the ship lurches or your fluidized sea decides to stop and you drop it and it hits the ground a little too hard, it's going to explode.
I feel like
don't drop them.
I feel like this is reinventing rockets with extra steps. I'll be honest. Like,
I was going to say this is no longer a cannonball, but a bomb that you're launching. You know, you're launching a bomb. You're not launching. And so thus you can't just carry it and transport it. Like, yeah, this is a metal cannonball, like a solid object cannonball meant to destroy by blunt force. It is now like I am transferring an explosive, therefore I must treat it carefully as if it might explode, you know? So, bit intense.
So yeah, if you have no idea what we're talking about here because you're listening on Spotify or wherever, come hop in our Discord. I will post this somewhere so you can see my picture of what we're talking about.
And then if it rains on your cannon magazine, that is a different definition of a rainy day.
For sure.
We had a Sazed mention. Did you guys catch it?
I actually did not write down where it happened, but when we got to the end of it, it somehow hit me. Wait, there was a Sazed mention in there somewhere. And it made me think about, Trevor, you warned us going into this, that there's a one-liner in this book somewhere that makes you hesitant to give it to a new reader, or like, we couldn't read this book sooner because there was a one-liner that would ruin something. Was that it right there? The Sazed mention?
It was, and I'll quote it for you. So this is Hoyd talking to the list, to whoever's listening to the book, talking about Ulam. And Hoyd says, ever since Sazed released them from their contract, they've been crazy. And Paul, we had your wife on for the first episode here. She didn't, that didn't spoil anything for her for Mistborn, right? However, if you have Elliot on this podcast and have him read Tress and then immediately pick up The Final Empire, he's going to be like, okay, hold on. And it would have completely ruined it. Because I almost read or had us read Tress before Mistborn. But because of that one line, you really can't. Especially if you're just going to go pick up Mistborn immediately after that.
I do agree. Even though I completely missed that line on my read through. Well, I did catch it, but about that in the Chondra, but
see, here's the thing. I went to an entire convention built around Mistborn Era 2. It was the release of the Lost Metal at Dragonsteel 2022. And I was rather worried going to that. We hadn't read any Mistborn at that point. I was worried I was going to spoil myself on a lot of things. And I can tell you, I sat in panels and Brandon Q&As where people straight up asked him crazy questions that I think were huge spoilers. I didn't get spoiled on anything huge other than maybe like, oh, I keep hearing this name pop up. I'll have to pay attention for that name. That's probably what I went into Mistborn with, was kind of knowing some names and knowing, okay, people care about that character. I'm going to pay attention.
Kelsier. There's a lot of Kelsier mentions.
There really was. And which, by the way, came as a, well, yeah, spoilers for Mistborn stuff. The I thought Kelsier was going to be a massive character in every single one of the books. And yeah, end of the first book. Well, yeah, gone.
Another side tangent from the side tangent we're already on. Do you now know why? Because at the very end of the last book they read in Mistborn Era 2, yeah, it's revealed to them that Kelsier's alive. And yeah, now we're about to pick up the Lost Metal. We know Kelsier's in it. Kelsier's on the mind. That's why.
So all of that to say, I bet 96% of people are going to read that and not remember it 30 seconds later. They can even go pick up Mistborn the very, you know, next day, and they're not going to remember it. They're not going to remember it. It's not going to mean anything in the moment, and they're not going to remember it. Now there's 4%, and I might be one of these four because I'm actually about to bring up a name that's name dropped a couple paragraphs later that means nothing to me now, but might in the future. If you read the book and you're taking notes and you write down as you go, weird, who the heck is Sazed and what does he have to do with this weird Ulam guy? Then yes, 4% get spoiled. The thing I would probably say you definitely can't do is you can't be halfway through Mistborn, set it down, go read Tress, and then go back to Mistborn. That will spoil something for you. Supposedly, I guess, like, you can't read this in between what's the book now? Well of Ascension and Hero of Ages.
Sure.
I feel like that's my take on this.
It's fair. Yeah. Your whole point of spoilers out of context aren't really spoilers. I actually do give a lot of weight because of that Dragonsteel that you guys went to, because there were, you know, plenty of things that you guys were absolutely spoiled on that meant nothing to you because the names didn't stick. You didn't have a mental impression of who that was, so the name didn't mean anything. So, yeah.
Speaking of other spoilers out of context, or I don't even know quite how to take this, did you guys catch a absolutely colossal reference that is not incredibly new for us, but it very much puts it extremely bluntly that was a blink and you miss it moment?
I caught it.
I bet you did. Paul, did you catch it? I'll read it for you. It's in the scene where Anne and Tress are firing the cannon. And Anne has terrible aim, like ridiculously bad aim. So everyone, it's a running gag in the book, right? She loves shooting guns and everyone like has to tackle her to stop her from shooting guns because bad things happen. In response to that, narrator Hoyd says this when Tress lets Anne fire the cannon. "That is probably the craziest, most reckless thing I've ever heard someone say. And I was literally part of a secret plot to kill God." Capital G, God. The last part is my addition there. Like, that is a statement.
Would you give this book to someone new to the Cosmere?
Oh.
It's one-liners like that, man. That obviously that's an Ad Nauseam reference, and he's referencing maybe his involvement with that. We still don't really know what's going on. So
hang on. Like I'll speak to that for a second. I think up until I read the sentence before that, I would have said exactly what you just said. The maybe possibly Hoyd was involved in something. He just came out and said it point blank.
Yep.
I was part of a secret plot to kill God. There's no more question in my mind whether Hoyd was involved in that or not.
There's also been a reference that he was gifted a shard at one point and turned it down. That was
I don't remember. Rhythm of War.
Did Odium say that?
No, it's Hoyd. I'm pretty confident it's Hoyd talking to Jasnah. And I remember it being, I could be wrong on when the conversation happened. I'm pretty sure it's a conversation between Hoyt and Jasnah. And it's when we get probably the most telling Hoyt reveals, I think, in the Cosmere. Mm-hmm. Of like, really, like he was there on that day and he was offered a shard and declined it.
Yeah.
But we know he was at least there, a part of the splintering or the shattering, which was to me like the biggest deal. This is quite the one-liner to stumble across, and I don't know what to make of it. I'm really fingers crossed that we will see that moment in writing one day from Brandon Sanderson. That's a big dream of mine. I don't know when or where that would be, but surely one day we'll get that scene, right? Hopefully.
Now that scene is in the posthumously published notes that his son puts together after he dies.
The Unfinished Tales.
Yes.
Good point, actually. Yeah, that's how it's supposed to come out.
I don't know if this podcast will ever cover it, but apparently Dragonsteel Prime, which is coming out next year, is uncanon. Like it's his original, like he's inventing the character of Hoyd, and Hoyd's running around doing stuff. But apparently there's stuff in there, which is coming out next year, which you can hypothesize on them all day, but none of it's canon. So can you really put much weight to it? Who knows? He's just releasing it for fun.
So I just realized I alluded to something a few comments ago and never followed up on it. So I should follow up on it.
The name.
Yes. There's a random name drop in here that means absolutely nothing to me. So I just tagged it as, what the heck is that? Hoyd makes a reference. We're talking about fire or cooking or something like that. Or maybe it's the sunlight spores. Sunlight spores seem pretty cool. They burn bright, so you can use them in flares and you can power your stove. And then Hoyt drops a mention like, oh yeah, and this bright thing that sometimes sets the beard of Tharg on fire. Who? I actually paused there, like full stop. I've said this a couple of times, and I really should maybe learn better. I'm starting to feel like I'm fairly well read in the Cosmere. There's not much left I haven't read. Like, fairly little. I know there's some obscure stuff out there, or yeah, non-canon, whatever. But to come across a reference like that, that seems like, again, back to the like inside joke thing, Hoyt is dropping all the inside jokes. I'm catching all the inside jokes because I know a lot about Cosmere. This one missed me. Who is Tharg? Should I know who Tharg is? What book have I not read that talks about Tharg?
Elliot, the Coppermine doesn't know who Tharg is.
Oh, man.
There you go.
But we do. We know he has a beard, so and we can write that part down, and Hoyt knows him. So,
and I'm going to ruin something for you guys and everyone listening here. Because remember that Sazed moment a second ago? Readers who didn't know blew past that, and it didn't spoil anything for them. We just spoiled ourselves on something. We don't know what yet, but we've just spoiled ourselves on something because I'm bringing this up and mentioning it, and it's going to stick in your head. And one day, we're going to read a Brandon book that is all about Tharg, and we're all going to go, hang on a second, we know something about Tharg, and we're going to have spoiled that book.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, actually.
I don't know why his
beard catching on fire is going to spoil it. Now I won't get to enjoy the Tharg POV chapters that we'll have coming in the future. Because I'll know he has a beard, and that's just going to ruin it all for me.
Yep.
So now any unnamed character that comes into our stories with beards, we're going to be like...
It must be Tharg. It
must be Tharg. So true.
Yeah. We better watch out for this guy. Crucial to the Cosmere.
Totally out of left field. A one-liner that I'm remembering from these chapters also is that, gosh, I think it's Hoyt talking because of the way it's phrased, but it could be Tress saying this as well. Is there's a comment that's like, I wonder if cobblers are good at making desserts, like if they're like a shoe cobbler, and I can't stop thinking of our cobbler character who is hosted an interlude in Stormlight. They're just being a little like pastry chef in the back.
Around
it. Yes,
Eam. I can't believe I remember his name. Eam.
Yeah, Y-M. Yeah, mm-hmm. Eam. But I just thought that was really funny one-liner. I was like, oh, wow. Okay, that's low. Brandon Sanderson is really... Either it's low-hanging fruit jokes or setting up elaborate stories to make one really stupid pun, like the ear elephant or whatever that was.
Irregardless,
that's right. Which is just ridiculous, and I can't stand it.
So by calling it low-hanging fruit, are we making terrible food puns about Brandon's terrible food puns?
I think so, yes. The cycle only spirals downward.
Will that make it peach cobbler?
Yeah, I suppose.
Low-hanging fruit?
Sure.
Yeah. We'll say yes so that it stops here, I think, is the plan. Yeah.
Sounds good. Anything else, gentlemen?
I think that covers pretty much all of my notes. There's a lot packed into these chapters. We're getting into it. It feels like with the transition of our characters, our ship from Verdant Sea to Crimson Sea, it did feel like there was a bit of a shift in the story. Are we going to get a little more focused now? Are we going to narrow in on our objective? Is Tress going to go from more exploratory to more objective focused? Curious to see if that'll be true.
Sounds good. Let's reconvene next week. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
Onward and upward.
Imagine Dragons.